Good evening. At this time, we begin the TechNet on Limehawk. Sorry, I'm a little bit late. For those who haven't heard the TechNet before, its major purpose is education. A little bit of entertainment sometimes sneaks in. People ask that question about ham radio-related subjects, and most of the time they get answers. A person signs into the TechNet by giving their call letters, their name, followed by a yes, and the yes means I do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like K2KEY, Mel, and yes. Do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2LAW.
And good evening, K2KEY.
M2EO, Rich, and yes.
W2PNJ, Bob, yes.
Okay, so far we've gotten Mel, Rich, and Bob. Anyone else to check in? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
W2TTT.
Gordon.
No questions.
Okay, Gordon with a no. Anyone else?
KC2MWA, just listening.
Okay, Bob with a no, but you wait. Some of these guys are going to hear what's going on and say, gee, I got a question. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, let's start off with Mel. What's new in Manhattan Beach, Mel? And what you up to these days? K2IW in the net.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, all on the net. This is K2KEY. Well, I've been getting some very positive emails about discussions that we've had in the last few weeks about, the Smith chart to solve some matching problems and all. And I thought maybe I'd continue one more time tonight with one more privilege that may be of interest, something that we haven't gotten to yet, and that's transmission lines. So whoever's out there, you have your Smith chart ready and a compass straight edge pencil, and we'll get that later. Another somewhat controversy that I got a number of emails on was comments about metric, about the use of metric versus what we've been always used to, anything of that sort. And, where does metric really fit into the picture if you're not used to using it? Of course, the only comments I did give a couple answers was saying that basically we've been using metric one way or the other for a number of years in different ways, such as right now we're on 2 meters, so we've been very used to using metric terminology, things like that, like 2 meters, 20 meters, or 15 meters, or whatever. And as far as measuring and all, because I maybe created a little confusion last week when I had mentioned, that we did some of the computations like the length of a stub and a distance in metric, converting it over. But if you look at your automobile in the last number of years, the doesn't manufacture even, whether they be American or foreign manufacturer, all the nuts, bolts, and everything in it are metric. So if you take, like, for instance, my old car, my old Chevy, I have a whole set of sockets that are basically useless in anything new. It's a shame because, all those nice sockets I have, Snap-on, V1, regular, and then box wrenches. And of course, on the other car, this isn't going to do anything for opening any of those bolts or tightening or loosening or whatever you want to do. So you have to have another set. So you just can't, walk away and say, forget about metric, I'll deal without it. And another one even said that he's been a carpenter for many, many years, and it's not going to change over at this point in measurements, using metric. So that's the controversy on metric. I don't know if you want to make any further comments on it. This is K2KEY back to X Control, KRIW of Limehawk.
Very fine. That was our Vice President, Mel. And when it comes to metric, you're going to have to slowly admit that the United States is a part of a world economy. You may think we're the major part, but we're only a part of a world economy. A large number of the things that are in your house right now and the things that you own were foreign manufactured, or portions of them were foreign manufactured. Your electric shaver may have been made in Holland by the Norelco company, and major portions of your automobile are probably manufactured in Japan and so on. So guarantee you own German and United Kingdom and French and African and so on and Australian products in your house. If you buy something from the Ramsey Company, you're buying ham radio products from an Australian company and so on. 90-some-odd% of the world uses metric, uses meters, centimeters, kilograms, grams, in order to measure things. So, you go to your drugstore, and the majority of the drugs are measured in milligrams, in grams. So we can sit here and say that I was brought up in feet, inches, and pounds, and miles. So what that the rest of the world uses centimeters, meters, kilometers, grams, and the metric system. You can't deny it. It's do any conversation with ham radio operators in other portions of the country. Try to tell them how high is your antenna, how far is it away from the house, what distance is it to the nearest store where you buy your electronic parts, and so on. You'll eventually find out that majority of the world is not using the system units that we use. So it's very difficult to deny it. Both bolts on your automobile are now measured in millimeters, which is a thousandth of a meter. And I'll be the first to admit it's a pain to learn the conversion, to buy your petrol in liters instead of gallons. It's a difficult conversion. I'll admit that. But we're not going to have a whole lot of choice because we're becoming more and more an international entity. Could insist that all the components of a process where you're manufacturing and selling something, you can insist that all of the process be American-made. Chance you'll survive doing that, but there's a higher chance that you will not survive. Because there are certain products, certain sub-assemblies, manufactured in foreign countries, where the price is cheaper, the quality in some cases might be higher, and those products are manufactured in a metric country, not our system of units. So that's an opinion. Mel is obviously going to be telling us more about the Smith chart for someone who doesn't already have one in their hand by simply Googling the word Smith chart. We'll rapidly find on your internet connection a number of websites where you can download a copy of the Smith chart and make yourself a paper copy, or even use it right off the screen, but the paper copy is a nicer way to go. Therefore, you'll see what Mel is talking about. You'll be able to draw it with a pencil and a straight edge and a compass, something to draw circles. You'll be able to follow along with lesson number 3. He thinks there's only going to be one more. I'll bet you there's going to be 2 or 3 more. It's a fairly extensive subject, depending on how far you want to go with it, depending on how much you want to use it. But when it comes to impedance matching, anything that contains a transmission line, convey RF energy, radio frequency energy, from one end to the other, most likely you're using a transmission line, know it or not. Anything beyond a fraction of an inch within an amplifier nowadays, a VHF, UHF amplifier, is using a transmission line to couple stage A to couple stage B. And it may be a microstrip, a strip line, a coplanar waveguide, a real piece of semi-rigid cable, a small piece of coaxial cable, and so on. Or when it comes to connecting that valuable RF power out of your transmitter up to that antenna that's on the roof or on the chimney or on the top of the tree or on the top of your radio tower, most likely going to be using a transmission line, unless you're a very serious microwave operator where you could be using beam waveguide. Not very many have done that yet, but that's going to change. So, transmission lines have got this peculiar characteristic where the impedance you put on one end and the impedance you see on the other end are almost always not the same. And it's not common sense. You may be using a 50-ohm transmission line, and if you put a 50-ohm antenna on the end, you think everything's hunky-dory. And it is, if it's a 50-ohm resistive antenna. If there's the smallest amount of capacitive or inductive reactants associated with that antenna, or if there's the smallest amount of deviation from 50 ohms, 45 ohms or 55 ohms, resistive component of your antenna. You put that on the far end of the transmission line. Common sense would lead you to believe that if you put a 45 ohm antenna at the far end, at the shack end of the transmission line, you'd think you're going to see a 45 ohm impedance. 99% of the time, you will not. They put 45 ohms on one end and see 55 ohms on the other end. As a very simple example, to get more complicated than that. And the Smith chart helps you relate those craziness of what really goes on with inside of a transmission line. So it's a valuable tool. Once you learn that, once you've been through Mel's course, and you've gotten a degree from the Schneider School of Electrical Engineering, which has its headquarters in Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn, well, once you've got that degree in hand, you can go out and sell your services, and you will make more money. Two ways about it. Any kind of RF skill, any kind of a wireless skill, any kind of skill with antennas, transmission lines, transmitters, and receivers. This modern day world, where wireless products are ubiquitous, they're everywhere, those are a valuable, that's a valuable skill to learn, to know, and it will increase your probability of being employed, and it will increase your salary to some degree. Mel's not guaranteeing how much your salary is going to increase, but it's going to increase. And job security is going to increase with that knowledge. If you're working for any kind of a company involved in any kind of technology, it doesn't matter whether it's the Category 5 cable that connects your computer in one location to a host computer in another location. That is a transmission line, and it obeys transmission line theory. It doesn't matter if it's the video cable that connects your remote sensing camera that's monitoring the front door of your building, and it gives you a picture on some other place in the building. These are all transmission lines. They all follow rules that are nicely illustrated with the Smith chart. So I didn't say it's simple, but it's worth making the investment. That's an opinion. Let's see what Rich is doing. What's going on over there in White Plains? N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW TechNet. Weimark, N2EO with Whitestone, not White Plains, Dick. Listen, if I run abruptly like last week, I hope you understand. My father has been ill, been taking care of him, so last week I had to run abruptly. Got a question about antennas, which closely relates to transmission lines. There was some playing around with 1.2 gigahertz FM. I just won a bid on eBay yesterday for a second handy talkie for 1.2. So there is stuff out there. It's Kenwood TH-55. I got it for $200 on eBay. Guy says it's in excellent condition. We'll see how it is when I get it. My question, Dick, is I'm trying to come up with a gain. I won't call it a gain antenna, but anything on an HT is going to have loss because you don't have a real ground plane. So put it this way, not a gain antenna, but less of a loss. Now, if I go to 5/8 of wave, which I believe is about quarter wave is something like 2 inches, I think, on 1.2. I'd have to do math. Go to 5/8. What do I do to bring the impedance back to 50 ohms? Or if I go beyond 5/8 to 3/4 wave, hard multiple of a quarter wave, will I get a 50 ohm impedance at the TNC connector on that HT? K2RIW, check that line mark, N2EO.
Okay, nice question. First of all, the 1296 handband, among the metrically influenced ham radio operators, among the microwave operators, 90% of them will call it the 23-centimeter band, because the wavelength of 1296 at the speed of light is 23.15 centimeters. Half wave is going to be 9 centimeters. Correction, 9 inches. Here we go. 23 centimeters. If you know your metric conversion, that 2.5 centimeters 2.54. Exactly. Centimeters is 1 inch. That's the definition of an inch nowadays, by the way. 2.54 centimeters. The standard length being used on planet Earth, traceable to the Bureau of Standards of both the United States and Europe, is the meter. The meter is 39.37 inches long. The standard meter is held in a very fancy laboratory in France, and that is the standard of length. It doesn't matter if you're measuring the distance between here and the moon, or between here and the other end of your printed circuit board, so to speak. The standard for length nowadays is the meter. So the mile and the foot, I mean, the foot has a very nice, convenient length to it because of the way we grew up, and I think the foot used to be defined as literally the length from the heel to the toe of the king somewhere, but obviously a king could have a big foot or a small foot, so it's not a very good standard by comparison to the meter is a given number of objects would be required to make the circumference of the Earth. The meter refers to the circumference of the Earth and the fact that one nautical mile, well actually it's a nautical mile, a nautical mile is a minute of arc on the at the equator. We won't go there, but I think the original definition of the meter was defined with reference to the circumference of the Earth. So, 23 centimeters, the 1296 handband, a wavelength of 9 inches, quarter wavelength of 2.27 inches. One of the things I'd recommend you do is you go to the website of WA5VJB, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo. A good buddy of mine who lives in the area of Dallas, Texas, he actually lives on something Plains. Can't think of the name of the town right now. Anyhow, at that website, I think it's WA5VJB.com. If not, you just simply go to Google and type in Whiskey Alpha 5 Victor Juliet Bravo, and good old Ken Britton will show you a series of extremely inexpensive green printed circuit board antennas. They must have about 50 different products there. And each one of those products is a couple of dollars. The price is right. And I'm using those things like they go out of style. The 900 meg version. The particular salt man where I spend quite a bit of time these days, that green three-element Yagi antenna, which is about 4 inches long, about 4 inches wide, and a 16th of an inch thick. For various experiments at 900 megacycles, there probably are 50 of those antennas running around the building, being used in various services, various places within the salt mine where I work, because they're so inexpensive, so ubiquitous, so easy to put a cable on them, a connector on them, or whatever. That is a 6 decibel gain Yagi antenna, the 900 meg version, that has beautiful coverage from 902 to 928 megacycles. I haven't seen lately, but I haven't looked, but I'm positive that Kent must have a 1296 version of that antenna. The 1296 version is probably going to be about 3 inches long, about 3 inches wide. It's going to have 3 elements, 4 elements, 5 elements, depending on which one you buy. It is a 50 ohm antenna. So if you want any kind of gain out of your 1296 anti-talkie, and you simply, with semi-rigid cable or whatever, somehow put a small piece of cable on that antenna and mount it to the output connector of your handy-talkie, and 6 dB of gain, which you can aim in any direction you want, like a flashlight. You can take the handy-talkie and either aim it out to the side or straight up in the air, so to speak, the Yagi antenna, and with 6 dB of gain, you can aim it in the direction you want. That's going to give you the best possible performance, better than a quarter wave or a 5/8 wave. You have to know which direction to aim it. What you're really looking for is an omnidirectional antenna. The difference in gain, Rich, between a quarter wave and 5/8 wave, when you put one on your automobile, the 5/8 wave definitely works better because the phase center of the antenna, 5/8 wave long, has a greater distance above the roof of your automobile. It's the extra altitude of a 5/8 wave antenna that's giving you 85 or 90% of the increase in performance. It's the altitude, not the real gain of the antenna. When you put a quarter wave antenna on a handy talkie, and you compare it to a 5/8 wave antenna on a handy talkie, you're about to ask, is there really an increase in performance? And that is not clear. And I'll tell you why. Think you're putting a quarter wave antenna above a ground plane, and you think the rest of the handy talkie is that ground plane. Well, I don't have to tell you that the handy talkie is not a great big sheet of copper with a quarter wave radiator in the middle. It's a cell phone shaped handheld object which is acting as the counterpoise to the antenna you put on the top. When you radiate energy into that antenna, you're pouring current into the antenna in order to apply the 2 watts of power, we'll say, that your handy talkie is generating. You're generating the exact same amount of current, whatever that is. I'm going to pick a number out of the air. Assuming you're launching 100 milliamps of RF current into that antenna, you're also launching 100 milliamps of current into the metal of the box inside that plastic of the handy talkie, which is in your hand. Therefore, to a small degree, that antenna is an offset fed half wave dipole. Quarter wave, you think that's the radiator. A substantial amount of the RF energy being radiated by that handy talkie is radiated by the package in your hand, and some of that RF energy is flowing down your hand and down your arm. So if I include your arm, your hand, the box of the handy talkie, and the rest of the antenna, is that a quarter wave antenna? Is that a half wave antenna? Is that a 5 wave, 8 wave antenna? The answer is yes to all of the above. It ain't clear. You go into a good anechoic chamber that's properly equipped, and you make yourself a sham hand or a replacement for the human hand, and you put the whole thing on a turntable, and you start measuring the pattern of that thing, you expect to see a quarter wave-like pattern. You will not. You'll see something considerably more complicated. Should you put all the extra effort in there to make it a quarter wave, a half wave, or a 5/8 wave, it's strictly a function of how did the manufacturer impedance match his particular rubber duck antenna, and why not use the rubber duck antenna that comes with it. You'll notice that with any of the handy talkies you can buy, if you go to any of the manufacturers who make rubber duck antennas, they don't make a single rubber duck antenna. They make one that works for Kenwood radios, they make one that works for ICOM radios, they make one that works for Yaesu radios. And at first it sounds crazy. A rubber duck you would think is a rubber duck. A quarter wave antenna is a quarter wave antenna. Each one of those manufacturers has his own favorite length of the favorite electrical length of the rubber duck antenna. And whatever the crazy impedance comes out at the base of that antenna, he has impedance matched to that particular antenna inside of the radio at the output of the transmitter. Therefore, if you took the rubber duck antenna intended for a Kenwood and plug it into an ICOM radio, it's not going to break up and explode and turn into fire, but it's going to work a tiny bit less efficient because the radio was tuned for a particular length of rubber duck. And hopefully the antenna connector on your handy talkie was tuned to something close to 50 ohms at that point so that you have the option of removing the rubber duck and plugging in an adapter that goes to the cable, that goes to the antenna that's on your chimney, on the roof of your house, on top of your tower, or whatever, on top of your automobile. You'd like to believe that it's going to get a good impedance match to a coax cable. You'd like to believe it's 50 ohms resistive at the connector of the handy talkie. Never quite true. And no rubber duck antenna presents a pure 50 ohm load. They're a little bit different than that. The good news is that that particular kind of impedance mismatch is reasonably forgiving. That is to say, if the handy talkie was impedance matched to a rubber duck, and maybe that rubber duck had an impedance of 40 ohms resistive and 20 ohms reactive. And when you put in a pure 50 ohm load on the connector of that handy talkie, it probably presents what the radio thinks is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio compared to the crazy impedance it was tuned to for that particular rubber duck antenna. So, in other words, a perfect 50 ohm load antenna with a transmission line that you connect with an adapter to to the output connector of your handy-talkie, the radio may think, because of the way it was adjusted, that that's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And you would think you're going to lose a whole lot of sleep at night over that impedance mismatch. Not to worry. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio between two different devices is an apparent insertion loss of 0.5 dB because of reflective power, because of impedance mismatch. 0.5 dB, which is a 12th of an S unit, is nothing to worry about. It would be very, very difficult for you to see the difference in performance when you went to the fringe of maximum range of the repeater you want to talk to, so to speak, and you go from case A to case B. One is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, one is a 1-to-1. So the radio, particularly in the receive mode, a receiver can tolerate a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio before any substantial difference in performance takes place. A transmitter, rarely will a transmitter be happy beyond 2-to-1, although handy talkies are a much more rugged final stage. They can take all kinds of beatings, because periodically a person forgets to put on the rubber duck and he squeezes the handy-talkie and starts transmitting into an open circuit. And that final stage of the transmitter has to survive that. Otherwise, you're going to start saying some terrible things about that brand of handy-talkie, and you're going to tell your fellow ham radio operators, and they're going to vote with their pocketbook, and that brand is not going to be popular anymore. So the guy who manufactures and designs that radio makes sure that that final stage is very rugged, and it can tolerate all kinds of standing wave ratio. So you've asked a very logical question, Rich. How do I impedance match a 5/8 wave? And in the case of a mag mount antenna for the roof of your car, if you study the insides of that, what the mag mount antenna does is that it has an extra coil on the bottom between the real radiator and the ground plane. That extra coil is adding length so that the 5/8 wave physical length of radiator is being brought up to 3/4 of a wavelength in electrical length. And your coax cable is tapped into that coil at the so-called 50-ohm point. It's tapped a certain number of turns from ground. Usually that coil is a printed circuit coil, a flat printed circuit coil, but it is electrically bringing your quarter wave up to 3/4, because every odd number of quarter waves of radiator is, again, resonant. Yes, half wave is also resonant, but a half wave antenna has an extremely high impedance of a few thousand ohms, whereas a quarter wave is around 35 ohms, and 3/4 wave is closer to 50 ohms. The resistive component, and again resonant, the reactive component disappears. So, as I said, the mag mount antenna usually is a coil with a tap to do the impedance matching. Can you do that with a rubber duck? With difficulty. Should you do it? Maybe no. Build yourself either a quarter wave, buy the right rubber duck, or if you start wanting gain antenna, consider using one of these printed circuit antennas that you mount on top of your handy-talkie. I'll admit it's not quite as rugged. It'll be a little bit challenging for you to make it a printed circuit antenna, to mount it to the rubber, to mount it to the output connector of your handy-talkie, so that you're able to drop it 50 times without it becoming damaged. But the antennas are so inexpensive, you buy a couple of them. But if you want gain, and that's the whole reason you went to 5/8 wave versus quarter wave, rather than trying to get the 1 or 2 dB, 1.5 dB of gain increase that in theory you get a 5/8 wave versus quarter wave, why not go all the way for 6 dB of gain and put a real antenna on that handy-talkie? Because the antennas become so small at 1296. A three-element Yagi is about 3 inches long and 3 inches wide on the printed circuit board. So you got a lot of choices there, as you can see, Rich. Good luck with that new radio. N2EO. The microwave handy-talkie operator of Whitestone, K2RAW on the TechNet.
WB2HWW with a comment, Dick.
Okay, Howie recognized. Let's see if Rich is there first. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, okay, Dick. K2RAW and 2EO. Well, I went to that website, VOA5VJB.com. Very interesting. He says 67 dB isotropic. Does have an antenna, printed circuit antenna, says 1250 to 1300 megs. I thank you very much. Might be an interesting project to put that on a handy-talkie with some kind of a mount, a rigid piece of coax sticking up. So fire, name it at a particular repeater. By the way, another piece of information, Dick. ICOM makes a very nice, you're listening to it now, microphone from their commercial line. It's a base station microphone. You won't see it in the amateur catalogs. I don't know why not. It's called an SM25 desk mic. It's a knockoff of the Motorola desk mic, and that's what I'm using right now. A little on the expensive side, about $150. I had it special ordered from Ham Radio Outlet, and works very well with the ICOM gear. Even though it's not commercial gear, it works fine with your amateur line. It uses a modular plug, and I got no problems with it. I'm one of the pants out of wound as well. Back to Ned and pick up Howard and anybody else pick. K2RIW, check that Limark, and 2EO.
Very fine, Rich. That SM25 is a good-sounding mic, and it's probably time that I change this mic to one that's got a little bit more high-frequency response so you can hear a little bit more about what I'm saying. Also, when it comes to that website, the BA5VJB, there's a very handy antenna. They're being sold by Ramsey Electronics, being sold by Radio Shack. They're a little bit on the rare side as far as the commercial world is concerned. As I said, there's about 50 of them running around the building where I consider it my salt mine these days and my main consulting client, so to speak. They had never seen those things before. They thought it's a very obscure product. They wondered where the hell I found that. If they knew that it's a ham radio-derived product being used in their commercial application, they wouldn't be horrified, but they'd be a little bit surprised. But doesn't matter. If you're an eclectic engineer, you gather information wherever it comes from, and because that's such an inexpensive, high-performance product that solves the problem, I mean, for a couple of dollars, you've got a zillion of these antennas available to you, and there's just no other better way to do it for a particular application where we're building arrays of these things to do direction finding, range finding, frequency selection, monitoring the environment. We've got them sticking on top of spectrum analyzers, got them sticking on top of network analyzers. We got them on all kinds of RFID equipment and whatever in the experimental stage. They haven't ended up into a commercial product yet. Well, I take it back. Yes, I take it back. One of the patents I hold is a drastic variation of that three-element Yagi, where I change a little bit of daylight out of it by making it with different materials, with different widths, in a different shape, and encased in rubber, and it hangs on the front of a handheld RFID reader. It's a variation of that antenna. Very crafty antenna, as you can tell. And the company I work for has got a patent with 30 claims on that particular antenna, referencing back to good old Kent Britton's antenna. So, Howie, what would you like to add to all this? What's your favorite kind of small antenna? And have you ever been to that website? Have you ever used any of these VJB printed circuit antennas? WB2HWW, K2IW in the TechNet.
WH-VNV.
VNV recognized. Pick you up in the middle of a minute, George. Okay, I thank you for that information. George, what would you like to add to all this?
I have a question for you, mate, while you were working there. And just a minor correction, actually the meter is now defined by a multiple number of wavelengths of Krypton 86. That happened several years ago when you were explaining that about the standard in France in a temperature-controlled environment, which is pretty close to a meter anyway. I have a question about if you're familiar with the AIL 7380 noise figure monitor.
Yes and no. I was there when the that particular product was created from the old, I guess in the very early days, it was called the Model 70 noise figure meter. I think it was the model number it had. And you're absolutely right. When it comes to a reproducible length standard, it's a zillion, something like 9,000 wavelengths or whatever of Krypton is the now version of the length meter. But the original length itself is a bar made out of some kind of material that has a very low thermal expansion coefficient. I think it's zero-door material, but I'm not absolutely sure. Anyhow, and the two scratch marks on this bar, and it's kept in a careful environment. That's the length standard for planet Earth. And rather than have everybody try to reproduce that bar and mail it to France and compare it with a microscope and whatever, someone has come up with the idea of, okay, you count the right number of wavelengths of this krypton when it's in the dual point resonance mode in a particular vacuum cell, and now in any laboratory, well-equipped laboratory in any other country in the world, in theory, you can reproduce the exact length of the meter rod. So it's a beautiful standard. Now, the old automatic noise figure indicators that Airborne Instruments Laboratory, AIL, used to make, and eventually became the Airtech Company and then EID, Electronic Instruments Division, it went through a whole bunch of different names, including MID, Microwave Instruments Division. The original machine only had just a Dawson valve movement on the front panel, and it indicated noise figure, and it had a calibrate mode. The later versions, they added digital readout of the noise figure as well as a readout of the gain. Turns out that when you measure the gain of an amplifier, or when you measure the noise figure of an amplifier, you're really measuring that amplifier in the presence of the rest of the receiving system. And so the noise figure of the rest of the receiving system is modifying the true noise figure of your amplifier proportional to the gain amplifier. So if you really want to know everything about your amplifier, you want to know not only its noise figure, its apparent noise figure, you want to know its gain in that particular environment. Once you know the noise figure of the basic meter independent of your amplifier, well, you attach your amplifier and remeasure the noise figure and go to the right calibration. You know the whole. That was part of the motivation for putting in that that digital circuitry for the higher numbers. Those model numbers later on included all kinds of functions, but automatically made
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay. Yeah, I am listening to you there. Okay. My question relates to I have one of these units now I acquired, and I have the 7615, the 28 volt pulse solid state source with the standard 15.5 dB ENR. But I've been very unsuccessful getting a manual for this device. But this one is a little different model. It has a 43 meg IF. As near as I can tell, it's just some kind of, I looked at the IF input, and it's just a big metal box. And then the output of that goes up to the circuit board. And I'm trying to figure out if I can just substitute a different IF strip, if you will. But I'm just looking for any additional information, or possibly anybody you know, or even maybe Jay knows, where I can get some schematics or other technical information. There seems to be nothing out there. I've searched all my manual sources on the internet and various other places. So, anyway, yeah, I don't know if we're timing out this thing or it's that funny carrier that's on there. K2RIWWHVNV.
Yeah, the timeout machine has been canceled, so not to worry, George. I'm hearing you very well on the input, so you and I will carry on the conversation regardless. Yeah, JK2OVS, there's a 10% or a 20% chance he can get you a manual. I can give you the name of one other human being who lives in Plainview that maybe can get you a manual for that because he worked for the division. 43 meg IF is a little bit unhandy for you and I because you'd like the IF to be 28 megacycles or 50 megacycles. They made, unfortunately, the standard product was a 30 meg IF and a 60 meg IF. The 30 meg IF would give you somewhat reasonable performance at 28 megs. The 60 meg IF didn't work super well at 50 megs, I'll warn you. So 43 megs is a little bit a crazy number. 43 megs of the IF, I think that number was chosen because most television receivers in the low VHF mode between 2 and channel 5, well, I guess in VHF upper also, are using a 43 meg IF, the standard for television. Even without the manual, George, if you have two or three pieces of basic information, you may be able to study the innards of the thing and get almost full operation out of it without the manual. The main thing you have to know is that the way it really works is it's a radiometer. For a radiometer to give you a very steady signal, it needs a significant integration factor. That means pre-detection, post-detection, bandwidth ratio has to be a pretty big number. the way an automatic noise figure indicator works is that the IF strip is more than 3 megacycles wide. The good news is that it takes 3 million samples per second, you could say, into its final detector circuit. The bad news is that if there's any weak carrier anywhere that falls into that IF strip by any means, it'll drive the apparent noise figure reading kind of crazy. Therefore, serious companies that do automatic noise figure indication tend to do it inside of a screen room to make sure that somebody's signal generator somewhere is not creating a crazy reading. So you've got 3 or 4 megacycles of bandwidth of the IF that goes into a square law detector. The output of the square law detector has a video integrator with about a 1 hertz bandwidth, about a 1 cycle time constant. So if you had a 1 hertz bandwidth on the video after the square law detector and a 3 megacycle bandwidth in front at the IF strip, you've got a 3 million to 1 integration factor. That means that the meter gives you a very steady reading without jumping all over the place, and you can, in theory, resolve differences of 0.05 dB. I didn't say you've got the accuracy of 0.05, but you can resolve 0.05 dB, or maybe even 0.03 dB of noise figure difference, and even gain difference with that machine, because it's a rather accurate radiometer.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I don't recommend that you try to change the IF to any other frequency, because the average guy who does that tries to mix it up or down to some other frequency, and as such, sum and difference is going quite a bit. So I don't recommend you try to convert it up or down. If you're real smart in the way you do the filtering and get rid of the reel and whatever, converting to another IF can be done. There was a version of the automatic noise figure indicator which had a tunable IF. It really was a super heterodyne system which had a tunable LO. Unfortunately, it was very, very difficult to use because there was an M by N product somewhere where somebody's carrier, somebody's LO came through, and therefore the automatic noise figure reading in noise figure was pretty difficult to believe. So I'd recommend you try to live with the 43 meg IF. I'll admit there are times when that's going to make some difficulty for you. Maybe that helps a little bit. As I said, do try checking with Jay. He's quite often on 6 meters out there. He now lives on the North Fork in Laurel, Long Island, on the North Fork, and he's on 6 meters quite frequently, so you'll run into him. As I said, there's a 10% chance he might know of somebody with a manual, and I know of one other man that I give you a 10% chance has got the manual. But once you've got the basic knowledge of how it works, I think you'll survive without the manual. WA2VMV, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2J.
Well, stand by. I bet you Eric's got a suggestion for you. Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what he's using for a noise figure measuring device.
Well, he said he's got the real 7615 solid-state source with 15.5 dB of excess noise ratio. So he's using the real source, and he's got the 7380 digital indicating automatic noise figure indicator. Back to you, Eric.
All right. Yeah, and actually in video we use a line to measure noise, and it's a constant, you know, repetitive signal. It gives us with no modulation or zero modulation. We have many different devices that actually pick that off and give a very accurate noise figure reading for television signal, but just for television.
Yeah, I think you're saying you don't make your measurement with broadband Gaussian noise source. You make it with a real unmodulated signal generator. Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, actually, we allocate a specific line. In our case, we use line 10, and based on that, we do noise detection on that particular line.
Yeah, the advantage of using a broadband is that you don't have to worry about the centering the center frequency of the signal generator into the amplifier that you're measuring. The broadband noise source, you use the right model number of broadband noise source, and it's putting out noise of a calibrated amplitude, and as low as 10 megacycles and as high as 18 gigahertz, depending on which noise source you buy. So the automatic noise figure indicator noise source is a very handy source where you don't have to tune it, so to speak. Just make sure it's going into a nearly 50 ohm a nearly 50 ohm impedance of the amplifier, and you get some pretty good measurements. So maybe some of this information helped you a little bit, George, to the A2VNV. Nice to hear from you. I think it's the first time you're signing into the Tech. It's about time. K2RIW TechNet. You got it, George.
Okay.
No, I'm pretty sure you've got it. And if need be, I'm listening to you on the input, so don't worry about whether or not you're getting through.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure beam and antenna and all that good stuff. Anyway, method and all, except in this case, my understanding is that the noise figure source is pulsed on off of 28 volts. That's what drives the 7615 source, which is fine. But there is a gain pot adjustment and or LED readout, which reads out a gain number. And I'm not sure if that's the gain of the IF or the gain of the external amplifier that you're measuring the gain of or the noise figure of that is in some way converted down to the 43 meg IF.
Okay, good question. First of all, yes, it is a 28 volt square wave that turns the noise source on and off. And the way the automatic noise figure indicator works is that it is a so-called Dickey switched radiometer. If your noise source was putting out 15.5 dB of TXS, if the amplifier in question had a reasonably high gain, so that it's overriding the noise figure of the rest of the, and if the amplifier was perfect, then the noise power coming out of the amplifier under test would have 15.5 dB of difference in noise power during the on and off mode. A 28 megacycle signal that turns on the noise source is a square wave at roughly 400 hertz. So it's a 400 hertz square wave. You could say 400 times per second the noise source is being turned on and turned off with exactly 50% duty cycle. The automatic noise figure indicator measures the noise on, integrates that, and puts it into capacitor number one. It measures the noise off, noise, power out of your amplifier, puts that in capacitor number two. You could say the meter is in between those two capacitors. The Dawson-Val movement is simply measuring what is the difference in decibels. If your amplifier is perfect, the answer is 15.5. The needle swings all the way over to the right, indicates 0 dB noise figure. As your amplifier becomes noisier and noisier, therefore it's contributing more and more noise during the noise off mode of the external noise source, therefore the difference of 15.5 becomes a smaller and smaller number, and if your amplifier is terrible enough, the difference between noise off and noise on is 0 dB, the needle will be over to the left-hand side, indicating infinite noise figure. So it's a Dickey switched radiometer. You now know a little bit more about how it operates. The gain that you care about is the gain of your amplifier. You have to know the exact gain of the total system, amplifier plus IF strip. You don't have to know that. However, in order to get proper operation of an automatic noise figure indicator, because it's really taking an extremely weak signal, a 15.5 dB of TXS is around minus 100 dBm per megacycle of noise power. It's in that order. By you and my standards, George, it's a very weak signal. Therefore, in order for the automatic noise figure indicator to work correctly, the total system gain, IF strip plus your amplifier, usually has to be greater than 70 dB. The gain number that you're adjusting is just trying to center the total gain power and the gain of the total system so that it's in the middle of the dynamic range of the square law detector. That gain number that you're setting is not super critical, but that's when you're setting the gain in the calibrate mode, it's the main thing you're doing. You're centering the gain of the total system that's got to be above around 70 dB in order for it to be above threshold to properly operate its automatic noise figure indicator. But when it tells you on its digital output reading during the measurement of your device on the test, and it's giving you a gain number, I'm almost positive that is the gain of the amplifier under test, because that's the number you want in order to crank back out how much noise figure is your amplifier and how much noise figure is being contributed by the rest of the system. So I think that's what it's doing when it's properly adjusted. Maybe that helps a little bit. WA2VNV, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, fine. K2RIW, WA2VNV. Okay. Yeah, the 100, the 400 hertz helps. I knew it was switched on and off, I just didn't know the frequency. And I assumed that the gain is going to be the gain of the external system that they take into account, the IF gain that's built into the box. So, for example, if I want to measure my noise figure on a 1296 front end, I'm working on a pole, a mass-mounted preamp system with some of these new exotic super low noise. It's beyond the gas fed. It's some other funny name that I can't remember, some kind of... I can't even pronounce it. Down to one to the IF within reasonable closeness to this 43 point whatever IF, and make sure I don't have a lot of birdies in that region, then I should work okay. Yeah, it does have a thumb wheel switch for setting the ENR based on the calibration points on the source. So you can dial in exactly what your ENR is, and then it's also got a readout of the noise figure. And it's my understanding that this is being a monitor as opposed to a meter. It's something that's left in the front end of a system all the time so that they can constantly monitor it. And maybe, as you say, it's part of this television IF thing that they can monitor the noise figure on a continuous basis using that line 10 over.
That could be very well, and maybe Eric will be giving us some further correction on that. When it comes to super low noise solid-state transistors these days, gas FETs, gallium arsenide field effect transistors is one of the ways. Hemp devices, high electron mobility, and beyond gallium arsenide, there's gallium phosphide and so on. These are probably some of the devices you're talking about, which are capable of a small fraction of 1 dB of noise figure at X-band and Ku-band frequencies. So some of these devices are capable of numbers like 30 degrees Kelvin of equivalent noise temperature, 0.03 dB noise figure type numbers at 1296. So it sounds like you're having a lot of fun at 1296. Yep, 400 hertz, you do dial in the 15.5, whatever the excess noise ratio is of your particular noise source, you do have to tell that to the machine. 15.5 is one of the standards, and 400 fraction is another one of the standards. And in some situations, a high-tech user of an automatic noise figure indicator will have in his transmission line going to his between his antenna and his receiver, he'll have a directional coupler. In some cases, it's a 20 decibel directional coupler, which has 0.05 dB of insertion loss on, because of about 0.05 dB of insertion loss on the straight little insertion to the of interest, 20 dB to a line. You've got your 400 cycle switched noise source with maybe a bandpass filter and maybe an amplifier to bring it back up in amplitude to correct for the 20 dB coupling factor. And then, and particularly if it's done with a filter off to one side of the desired frequency of interest, downrange is another pickle-up directional coupler with the same kind of a filter going into the automatic noise figure indicator. So you could be continuously monitoring the noise figure of an exotic receiving system by making a measurement off to one side in-wise, and because any amplifier that is broadband frequency, usually it changes at all of those frequencies approximately the same amount. So you could do inline monitoring without interfering with the normal operation of the system. I think that makes some sense to you. And back to you if you've got any further questions on this. And give me a landline, and I'll tell you the call letter. I'll tell you the phone number and name of another man who possibly can get you a manual, but it's a little bit of a long shot. WA2VNV, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, K2RIW, WA2VNV. I don't think I have your landline number, but I'm in the phone book if you want to look me up. I don't know if you're in the phone book anymore, over.
I am. You'll have no trouble finding me. And when it comes to sending me a message, my call letters at arrl.net will get it right to me. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I have the same thing on optonline.net with my call, so one to the other, no problem. I'll fire that off later to you. So, all right, I appreciate some insight, and Yeah, I'm not going for anything exotic. You know, below maybe a half a dB would be wonderful, because it's going to be all terrestrial. You know, I'm not doing any satellite or moon bound, so I'll be looking at, well, at least half of my pattern will be looking at the Earth temperature anyway. Unless it's really cold out, right?